Thank you. Good evening. Before I read a lecture, which I'm not in the habit of reading, but this award was so significant that I actually wrote one, so I would read it. I'd respond to Sherman in terms of what defines a life. A life comes out of a commitment. Mine was defined by my grandmother. She was an educated woman, a rare breed. My family has been dispossessed for 7 generations, every generation. We lost everything, every generation. Wrong side of a foreign invasion, wrong side of a civil war. But one of the outcomes of one of those, one of my ancestors defeated the first British army in Afghanistan in an organized battle, but then lost the civil war. So all my family went to exile. And the result was that my grandmother was educated. And when she came back, at a time when the elite did not believe in education, she insisted that we acquire education. In second grade, I refused to go to school one day, and it's the only time that she's touched me physically, saying that that was non-negotiable. Afterwards, when she was complaining that I was spending too much time on my master's or my PhD, I would turn back and say, "Grandmother, you said that was non-negotiable." But the quest for learning is to come from a problem. And the problem that I've dealt with has been the question of how do you create a level playing field for people of diverse backgrounds in order to be able to join in a common quest for moving forward. My best friend from my early days became a cartwheel driver. I ended up as Professor Johns Hopkins. And here is where the core idea of the contract comes back. I've been really privileged at Kabul University to spend 3 months in process of consultation with the university students in 2005. What I found was immense talent and creativity in the first year. In the fourth year, the same students were cynical, outright rejectionist, and sometimes outright criminals. Why? Because we, as the elite, the intellectual leaders of the country, failed. And the world at large failed the Afghan students. There is no, as I will illustrate in the talk, no American company has any difficulty acquiring $200 million not to deliver any value in Afghanistan. But nobody will invest in this country where $15 billion a year are poured into military activities to invest $1 billion in the future of the country to create first-rate universities. You could not have your parents here without the GI Bill of Rights. Your middle class is product of state intervention, public intervention. The economy is a fiction in your minds. It has to be created through institutional public order. There is no such thing as a spontaneous market. And we need to come to terms with design of the institutions that allow the poor to become stakeholders in a system. And rules matter. Because of this, when people ask me, why did I go back to Afghanistan? You know, I mean, I had an incredibly comfortable position in the World Bank, etc. The answer was very simple. I'd signed a contract that I would work for every year of my education 1 year. I had worked 4 years in Afghanistan, and I owed him another 3. So it was a penance to serve in the Afghan cabinet. And of course, I did it pro bono. But that's the type of contracting arrangement that we need to respect. That an investment in our education needs to be returned back with a dividend. The global part, I've been privileged, you know, to work in China, India, the rest of the world. At the core of it is our common humanity. What has struck me across the board in all my working, I've been to half of Russia, half of China, half of India, for instance, is that we do share a common sense of understanding. But we've created continuous blocks to misunderstanding. So with that on biography, which I wasn't intending, let me actually acknowledge properly. It is both an honor and privilege to be here with you to receive the Mayer Award, particularly because Jean Mayer exemplified what I'd like to call the best of pragmatic idealism. He deeply believed in equity and commitment to the poor, and saw public policy as the critical instrument necessary to create a level playing field for the excluded and underprivileged. In preparation for this talk, I was reviewing Mayer's work and was struck in particular by the Lowell lecture he made on 15 May 1989, and I would recommend that you all read it. He focused that day on food policy, arguing that, and I quote, "science by itself does not constitute nutrition, unless and until a program of action is incorporated as part of the discipline." End of quote. Mayer pointed out that greater knowledge brings greater responsibility, and only if you involve the middle class in a reform effort involving the poor will you meet with success. He also formulated the groundbreaking doctrine of nutrition rights, inspired by the concept of civil rights, which spearheaded the formulation of food programs in the U.S., targeting children in particular. Finally, he criticized the inefficiency of international aid, arguing that the generosity of spirit that produced the Marshall Plan had given way to ineffective and counterproductive aid practices. These insights are as relevant today as they were in May 1989. I thought a focus on three issues that are of critical importance to us: hunger, development security, and the environment would provide an interesting basis for understanding Mayer's prescience, exploring how the international aid syndrome is so ineffective, and how best we can improve the way things work. The FAO now estimates that about 850 million people around the world are currently undernourished. Isn't this the shame of our times? With so much plenty, still 850 million people undernourished. Thus, the dimension of the problem that Mayer identified is clearly very much with us. The number of food and humanitarian emergencies is doubled, from 15 per year in 1980 to more than 30 since 2000 as a result of poverty, conflict, and natural disasters. U.S. food aid averages around $2 billion a year in annual and supplemental funding by Congress, and the estimated number of beneficiaries has been around 70 million people. $2 billion in aid, but only 70 million mouth-fed, because the cost of management and logistics constitutes 65% of the U.S. food aid. 65% of the food aid is spent on management and logistics. The current rules and regulations that emphasize support for American private sector prevent efficiency. For example, cargo preference laws require 75% of food aid to be shipped on U.S. flag carriers, which are most costly than many other national carriers. This inefficiency is counterproductive and avoidable, as Mayer well understood. If we want to act pro-poor, we need to change the rules of the game that the powerful set for creating the instruments for working with the poor. Changing the level, the playing field on poverty begins with the top. In Afghanistan, the unintended impact of food aid on the ground was the exacerbation of poverty and at times a shift to criminality. Representing the Afghan government in 2002, I argued strongly with food providers that markets were efficient in Afghanistan. And given seasonality of production, because we have a 6 month period over which wheat matures, one needed to support the market to signal to farmers that their products were valuable. This required the use of modern technology to estimate domestic production and careful use of food assistance at the right time and in the right place. However, instead of a carefully calibrated strategy, the World Food Program released large quantities of food indiscriminately. For the first time in our history, Afghan farmers found it unprofitable to harvest wheat because the cost of food at the market was lower than the cost of production. Javed Rezaian, which I'm very privileged to acknowledge, was actually working in northern Afghanistan, could give you first-hand examples of this. In the next 2 years, we also saw a massive shift in the production of opium. And while there's not a direct cause and effect relationship between the two, it is indisputable that there was a lack of alignment between the type of support that would reinforce food production by the poor and the food dumping approach by the international community. The targeting of food distribution has been a huge problem. In Afghanistan, relying on cash for work would have reinforced local market relationships and investment in agricultural productivity and would have been more successful. But the aid system acts against rational interests of the poor. The core issue here is that we need to deal with the causes of hunger, not the symptoms. The poor do not need charity. They need effective interventions. Charity makes us feel good, but it makes the poor feel awful. And we need to change the fundamental relationship. Dealing with the causes means three central tasks. Firstly, renewing a commitment to pro-poor agricultural policies that reduce poverty. The nature of public intervention is to be different, with an emphasis on building effective markets and ensuring that the United States and Europe reform agricultural subsidies. The amount that the United States and Europe provide in agricultural subsidies is the greatest disincentive to food production in the rest of the world. And charity, when 75% of it is spent on administrative cost, is privileging a sector of American business, not the poor. Secondly, applying modern agricultural techniques where they are needed. The science of agriculture is very advanced, but has yet to find its grand mère, in that it is to find champions that can turn the science to a basis for an agenda for action in developing countries. Land-grant colleges, created and funded as part of pro-poor public policy in the United States, have played a vital role in the development of agriculture in the United States. These colleges and the knowledge that they embody need to be linked to a global agenda for agricultural reform through partnership with institutions in developing countries. And thirdly, social policies to reach the ultra-poor need to be thought through. Current social policies, where it takes $5 to deliver $1, are not the way to proceed. And we need to think about instruments again in fundamentally new ways. Food aid is one aspect of the larger aid syndrome. The aid discourse has become focused on poverty, empowerment, and inclusion, gender, all the right words, human rights. But there's a disconnect between that discourse and the instruments for the realization of those goals. Let me take just a couple of examples. American aid is captured by a development security complex that has become strongly entrenched through a powerful set of interest groups, cross-cutting lobbying, shipping, NGOs, and particularly congressional allocations. The Government Accountability Office explains that the Department of Defense continues to lack the capability to provide information on the totality of contractor support to deployed forces. In the Balkans in 2002, the Department of Defense was unaware of the number of contractors operating, the task they were contracted to do, and the government's obligations to these contractors under the contracts. Reports indicated the situation in Southwest Asia and Kosovo was similar in 2003. The record of delivery of aid is damning in Iraq and has reached massive proportions. The GAO has recently released a report entitled Stabilizing and Rebuilding Iraq. Conditions in Iraq are conducive to fraud, waste, and abuse. That's the title. The report details a heavy reliance on contractors, with the Department of Defense entering into contract arrangements on reconstruction effort that have posed additional risk to the government, with officials again unable to determine how many contractors were deployed and therefore the cost of those contracts. As of March 2004, about $1.8 billion had been obligated to reconstruction contract actions without the Department of Defense and the contractors reaching agreement on the final scope and the cost of the work. 18 other billion dollars were affected in similar way. The net result is a lack of strategic focus. The report argues, and I quote, that U.S. planning efforts have been plagued by unclear goals and objectives, changing priorities, inadequate risk assessment, and uncertain costs. End of quotation. In Afghanistan, as the person in charge of development planning between 2002 and 2004, my priority was to connect the northern provinces with the south. I obtained financing from the World Bank, which through its procurement process sent an American firm to carry out the construction of the Kabul-Kunduz road. I then focused on support for the Kabul-Kandahar road in the south, with support from USAID, which chose the same American firm as the contractor for that road. This firm promptly shifted all its attention to the southern road because that was the priority of the U.S. president, entirely neglecting the northern road, causing immense political difficulties in terms of the perception of equity among northerners to whom I promised change and obtained the money to deliver on that change. This had an incalculable effect on the government's legitimacy, given that building trust in post-conflict environments is an essential task. Most USAID contracts are assigned to six firms around the beltway, who in turn subcontract through as many as six layers. The end result is that as little as 10 cents of every American dollar is actually spent inside the country it purports to help. The government of Afghanistan had a clear development strategy by April 2002. Having written hundreds of these strategies for other countries, I could produce one very quickly, and I did in 4 days. To which the rest of the international community was increasingly buying in, because we convened the first Afghanistan Development Forum after the devastation of the Taliban, believe it or not, in April of 2002, in Kabul, chaired by us. And unlike any other meetings, I wrote all the speeches of the foreigners. Because when the World Bank came to offer to write my speech, I said, this is what I used to do for others. You know, why do I need you? This strategy embodied, then we developed the strategy, which was embodied in securing Afghanistan's future, which was kindly mentioned. And that was presented to an international community in April of 2004, 2004 in Berlin and received endorsement from over 60 finance and foreign ministers. However, by the end of 2004, USAID, as again pointed out by the GAO, had not only failed to develop a strategy for Afghanistan for its own expenditure, but had actively refused to buy into ours, creating parallel institutions and parallel organizations. As a result, the Afghan public has become disenchanted with the slow pace of development and the lack of transparency and accountability of American-led development efforts. The developed world has taken a habit to lecture the underdeveloped world on its lack of accountability and transparency. I'd like to submit the evidence to you as to who lacks transparency and accountability. And why do we need a different compact that mutually binds us? This is not a blame game. But we need to move out of narrow interest towards broader citizen-based focus. The pattern that emerges from these examples is that outsourcing of government functions in the United States is reached a point where accountability is evaporated. Noble intentions are frustrated by the reality of practice. Time and again, audit reports point out to the fact that food aid and foreign aid supervision are extremely limited, but little changes in practice. Audit reports are fantastic documents if you really want to know what's happening. They require mastery of a language as arcane as any, but once one is mastered, they provide the dye that provide the full diagnostic. It is not enough just to focus on increasing aid. There's a very well-meaning lobby that keeps lobbying for increase in aid without focusing on the mechanism. Increase of aid without change of the mechanisms and rules is not going to bring you any more impact for the poor. Current level of aid could be put and made effective at least 20, 30 times more. And that should be our first task. Because without fundamental reform of the aid system in the United States and elsewhere, outcomes in terms of equity and opportunity for the poor will not improve. Rules and regulations from the 1940s are not suitable for the 21st century context. America cannot be claimed to be the center of global competitiveness and the home of a vibrant private sector while simultaneously creating a security development complex that captures its aid. The United States is not anomalous in this regard. Most global aid to various degrees is captured by contracting firms. Therefore, the global rules that support this complex and prevent the creation of functioning states and functioning markets on the ground need fundamental rethinking. Witnessing the security development complex in action has led most non-governmental organizations and civil society groups working in developing countries to advocate the doctrine of do no harm as the first rule. Isn't it sad that our first rule of business now should be to preach to ourselves that we should do no harm in continuously documenting that we are actually doing harm? Civil society and universities here, the social organisms that underpin the vibrancy of the American middle class, need to be brought into this debate in particular, because unless these issues become issues of public discussion, they will remain marginal and the effect will be perpetuation of the current inefficiencies. After all, aid comes from taxes, and taxes part of the social contract of the obligations and rights of citizenship. Hurricane Katrina showed that these failures are not confined to foreign aid operations. These implementation issues are as significant domestically as they are internationally, will only persist as environmental problems continue. In a world that is 1 degree warmer, and I'd like to acknowledge particularly the profound thinking of Nina Goodwin on me for many years and on the global world for calling our attention to this, the Western United States could once again be plagued by perennial droughts, devastating agriculture, and driving out human inhabitation on an unprecedented scale. In a world that is 2 degrees warmer, in the southeastern United States, lower summer rainfall and soaring temperatures could slash sorghum and soybean production in half. In a world that is 6 degrees warmer, the entire global population might be living with or dying as a result of issues such as ocean stratification and hydrogen sulfide poisoning. Our global systems are of human making, but not of human design. The future is becoming more difficult, so the more we postpone action, the greater the problem. We must be proactive rather than reactive, and the entire nature of public policy now needs to be geared towards coherence. This in turn requires a medium and long-term view as an issue of design. The consequences, if we do not start thinking in this way, are almost too devastating to imagine. In the past, public policy is assumed that the future is either benign or improving. Today, with environment, we don't have the luxury. We need to think about our consequences of our actions now and rethink the nature of public consensus and action vis-a-vis 10 to 20 years ahead of time, not in reactive ways. Because reaction to those events, as Katharina showed, are only going to be devastating results. The global poor are the most vulnerable to the threats emanating from food, security, and environment issues. Not only do we need to focus on the relationship between short and medium-term actions in these realms more consciously, we also need to map backwards from our shared future objective to today's organizational constraints and deduce how best to remove these constraints. This requires concerted action at the local, national, regional, and global levels, in coordination between efforts at these levels. As John Dewey once remarked, only continuous inquiry, continuous in the sense of being connected as well as persistent, can provide the material of enduring opinion about public matters. Because these issues are global, the public that is affected by them is global. And one of the most significant challenges for us now is how to exercise public power. If we are to tackle the key challenges of our times, we must reach a consensus on the role of national and international public institutions in the 21st century. In his Lowell Lecture of 1989, John Mayer concluded, "We need a change of priorities, a conversion. If you believe with me that greater knowledge brings greater responsibility, we have the knowledge and have very little excuse." So he concluded, "This plea for a change in priorities has never been more pertinent. The AIDS syndrome is part of a pathology, and like any pathology, needs reform, but reform cannot come without debate through public discussion. Only in this way can the disconnect between theory and practice be overcome. Universities, particularly distinguished ones, such as Tufts, cannot be ivory towers." And I know that programs like EPIC are not attempts at being ivory towers, but to be attempts to be at the world and to change it. They have to be part of the vibrant tissue of debate and discussion and provide the ground for formulation of alternatives to present realities. Dealing with causes rather than symptoms requires a major focus on institutional design, and the nature of public power is central to this. Our view of public power is to change from an instrument of constraint to a tool for enabling the achievement of collective objectives and aspirations. We live in an interconnected world, and we cannot tackle global issues in isolation, only in partnership. Clash of civilizations can only be a fulfilling prophecy, not analysis. This requires revisiting the design of international organizations and aid, and the United States must play a central role in this process. Honoring John Mayer is a way for us to engage with both the enduring challenges that he was cognizant of and the enduring legacy of hope that he's left us with. Human agency is and can be the major instrument of global reform. We must change our minds and reorder our priorities. Our survival depends on it. Thank you.
your turn. Laura?
Hi, my name is Laura. I'm an Aspen student this year. When you were speaking of the farmers in Afghanistan, their inability to compete with farmers in the United States because of subsidies given by the United States government, I couldn't help but think in the Times recently there's been a focus on, in Afghanistan, the growing of opium. So my first question is, do you think the focus in Afghanistan on the opium trade is as a result of lack of opportunities in other farming markets? And if that's true, if you could kind of frame that argument for the United States to sort of end subsidies for American farmers.
Thank you for the question. First of all, it's not just the United States. Of course, European Union is the largest amount of subsidies for extremely ineffective farmers. My first point is a level playing field. The World Bank and the IMF would not lend to any country that subsidized its agriculture and dismantled half of the agriculture in Africa on the basis of that doctrine. Look at peanuts in Senegal or other set of activities. If it makes such good economic sense that the poorest countries should not engage in that practice, what's the justification for the richest countries? So first point, just the level playing field. Either economics is national and actually subordinate to a political economy of power in a consensus, or it's a science. Currently, it's not a science. It's an art, and Nina Goodwin, Professor Nina Goodwin, will tell us a lot more about what's useful and what's not. Second, aspect of my argument, that in case it was not clear. In 2002, opium was rare. Food aid became a driver of opium. Because I argued with people, you know, the current agriculture, the current food subsidy policy is that the United States will only give food assistance in kind. It refuses to provide food assistance in cash. What's the difference? If you provided food assistance in cash, one, the cost of transport, etc., administration would drop very significantly. So instead of 750 million going to administration in 250 billion, so that is almost 1.5 billion. 1.5 billion is going to administration, 500 directly. The ratio would be the other way around. With that, one can buy from regional markets and national markets. So signal to them that food production domestically and regionally is critical to relief of emergencies. There's not a part of Afghanistan that you could not reach through the market mechanism. The issue was not lack of access. The issue was lack of money to buy. Because we have known the market for a couple of thousand years. And yet we are being treated as though we were from Stone Age and didn't know how the market functioned. Three is sensitivity in terms of the direction of using modern technology. You know, we have today 1 square meter resolution for all the territory of Afghanistan through satellites. Food companies, particularly wheat companies, during the height of the Soviet Union, perfected the art of predicting harvests. Because the future depended on it. How much the Soviet Union was going to buy was a critical driver of world market. With that kind of technology, you could predict very reliably what the harvest would be. And based on that, could design a food distribution system to reinforce rather than destroy. What happened was the exact reverse. So this is the point about Mayer's point, that we have the knowledge, but we don't put it. Now, regarding opium, two sets of issues. One is criminality. 20 individuals in Afghanistan controlling the entire heroin trade. Not a single person in this country or in Europe or in any others is willing to name them or to take legal action against them. So one cannot practice both hypocrisy and cooperation. At the farm gate, the price of what is coming, Ethiopian, is about 850 million to 1 billion a year. It's a 24 billion industry, 22 billion of which is caught outside Afghanistan. And every single nation along the way is involved. But it's specific elites and networks that are engaged in criminality. Why are we not focusing on the rest of the 22 billion? And we need, because this is again the level playing field argument. The cost of heroin in London is cheaper than a cappuccino. It has dropped continuously every year the last 10 years. So, last point. The answer to opium is global market relationships. Because, again, I could design a system here with scientists with a variety of experts to be able to get agricultural productivity to a level of industrial development. But the world has to make a choice. What's the choice? Either legalize drugs, then opium becomes a commodity. And as any economist would tell you, that Afghanistan will have no advantage in growing opium globally. Because there are hundreds of other places that could grow it better, and there'll be no demand. Why is that not being done? Because the politics of middle class in these countries is not going to accept it. No politician is going to come out and stand up and run for election on the basis of legalization. If that is your political constraint, don't force me to cut the heads of the farmers there. We have to talk sense to each other. Here there's politics as a constraint. There's no politics as constraint. Alternatively, come with an economic design strategy that creates the investments necessary to get out of this. At $1,000 income per legal capital, income per capita legally, there's no opium production. It doesn't make sense because it's back-breaking work. So cotton will not compete with opium, but t-shirts will. Now the question is, will people be willing to create the conditions for production of t-shirts? Yes, please.
Identify yourself, please.
My name is Juliet. You gave an example about the roads in the north and the south of Afghanistan and how they were each financed by different institutions, but the same company was building them. And I'm curious if the tendency for this company to focus on the southern road came from where this particular individual company, the Lucas's, to work in the American company, or if it's representative of power that international institutions and where the money is.
No, the interest was very simply, but there was no end to money. President Bush favored us and said that the north-south, the southern road could be constructed, and we chose it because it was the longest road. And he really ordered that the road be constructed within 1 year. And this American company was going to make an incredible amount of money from it. And it said, help to the other road, which it contracted with. So it ignored its contractual obligation. And the World Bank did, again, lack the supervision capacity to understand and hold the company. And I was working 16 hours a day, but I could not supervise every single contract. And by the time it ended back on my desk that the thing was not moving, and I called them in, I read them the riots act. Then they started moving.
Our guys?
Your guys. Yes, sir.
Hi. Thinking about the example you used about how the WFP, because of the food provision, kind of messed up the market of departments providing food. I don't know much about the situation in Afghanistan after the conflict, after the Americans went in, but my thinking is that I don't think, obviously, the WFP is not there to intentionally screw up the market, but especially in situations, in post-conflict situations after the Americans have gone in, certain institutions, certain markets, as you say, the markets may be efficient, but directly in the aftermath, they may not be running as well. So we have the direct, I would assume, situation where people are in need of food, but they can't get it. And this implementation of a good, efficient economic strategy will take time. And in the interim, you have people who are starving, people who need food. So my question would be, given that we do know it's a trade-off like this. You know, if the WFP comes in and immediately subsidizes or provides that kind of food to achieve a short-term goal of preventing starvation and death from the lack of food, how do we find that balance? How do we, you know,
well, extremely good question, but a couple of assumptions in it. First, you're assuming that WFP is a functioning organization with accountability and transparency. Let me bring one thing to your attention. This is the same organization, like six other UN agencies, that refuses to provide audit reports even to its board of governors. So its board of governors, people who are providing money, are actually not provided with the reports. Second, organizational interests have now running wild. If you read the Oil for Food inquiry, that's one of the most intensive engagements headed by Paul Volcker. The extent of corruption in running of Food for Aid becomes very clear to you. What is the nexus? Every single company in the developed countries and in the developing countries was involved in this scandal. So corruption has become organized. It's not disorganized. Third, there are another 5,000 pages of reports from the UN's own inspectors. I had to consider this because I was a candidate for becoming Secretary General of the UN, so I had to actually examine the material. And I was sure. So we are dealing with organized series of interests that do not have the accountabilities. That's the first point. So this provides a different thing. This is why I'm saying, as citizens, we assume good intentions and say X amount of money has to go to humanitarian purposes because we have not thought through about the problems of implementation. Implementation is messy. That's why it's not sexy. That's why the ivory tower does not teach it. You know what you require in the World Bank? Only how to operate the phone. There's not a single course on how to manage a project. Or at the UN. It evolves. Everybody makes mistakes and they learn. Does formal economics give you ground for managing large-scale projects at the World Bank? No, but that's the pattern of recruitment. So there are lots of mistakes that are happening. You know, so you're coming from Singapore, where the most efficient management of public enterprise has taken place. 94% of housing in Singapore is provided publicly without any corruption. It went over in the course of 40 years from being one of the most corrupt to being one of the cleanest. And where government and the private sector work arm in arm to produce public value, particularly in terms of housing. But that's not the rest of the world. Second is, there's a question of how markets receive signals. There's a lot of misperceptions about post-conflict countries which have been part of market mechanisms for millennia regarding assumptions that there's no functioning market. As a test case, and again, Javed would be able to provide you a lot more illustrations, bring money to any remote part of Afghanistan and see how quickly the market responds to it. The issue is that the United States refuses to provide any of its food assistance in cash. The other is, assuming that Afghan markets were not functioning, markets in Pakistan were functioning, markets in India were functioning, markets in the Gulf were functioning. You could have bought them the food at one-tenth of at a very significant reduction at the regional market. Markets in Kazakhstan were totally functional. Kazakhstan had huge quantities of food. But no, that was not to be. All those options were ruled out, not because they were not real economic options, but because there were political policy options that had been decided through a nexus that had been arrived through rules in 1940s to subsidize the American private industry. And at that time, that made sense because it was right after the wake of World War II when the industry needed support. But today, it's a different environment. Then comes the third one. How do you make the balance? By targeting. By making sure that this distinction is being often made. Do you give the poor fish or do you teach them how to fish? If you're going to be destroying the livelihood of people where they're not going to harvest, you know, there's nothing more precious to a farmer than what she or he is cultivating. And if that farmer refuses to harvest what they've spent their literal blood and sweat on, that is quite a condemnation. So Ebbing understood that food was not going to work. A lot of these provinces shifted to opium. Because then they tested the government. They said, we don't have a social contract with us. The rest of the international system doesn't have a social contract with us. But the drug dealers do have a contract with us. And I wanted to deliberately bring a real extreme example. Because the poor in the rest of the world do not have the option of growing opium. But here was one place they did. And the consequences for world stability and order have been quite serious. Because the unintended, I'm not saying that this was an intended impact, but what we need to hold ourselves responsible for are now the unintended results of policies that we practice. Because it's the result, not our intentions. And this means really thinking from objective backwards and very carefully working. Because now we know the patterns. Yes, please. This is one area where somebody from Boston, actually the former director of USAID, Andrew Natsios, tried to break this nexus. He completely failed in Congress. The set of interests that are benefiting are enormous. The shipping lobby, the farming lobby, and the NGOs. Because a lot of NGOs are paid in kind for the management of their operations. And unless this nexus is broken, it has nothing to do with fungibility, because food is equally fungible. You know, if targeting does not exist, the corruption becomes quite high, and then you're able to sell it. So just is another way, only that you've forced the transactions through a series of other steps. There was a question at the back. Yes. Yes, you, sir. Yes, absolutely, sir.
On the WTO's stance via these subsidies, because it's an astonishing allegation. I mean, if I were writing a blogger, if I were to put this on the internet, it's counterintuitive that a country that prides itself on its fairness should should sponsor institutions which allows its own company subsidies, but don't allow subsidies to go to other countries.
Thank you for the question. Let me first be very clear as to what I said. The World Bank is no advice capability with what are called OECD governments, with developed country governments. So it has no role in setting the internal agricultural policy of the United States or France or Germany or anybody else. These policies are arrived at through domestic political processes and are a reflection of previous history. Enormous amount of work has been done both on the impact of subsidies in the United States and on European Union. So this is a fact that these governments are subsidizing their agriculture, and Japan is equally part of the equation, to very, very significant effects. And the facts and figures are in. Second, as a matter of good economic policy, a lot of the development institutions, not just the bank, have been practicing in inter-subsidies in developing countries. In Africa particularly, there are lots of examples, Senegal standing, and the rest, where arrangements where the government was directly involved in support or marketing or others were dismantled during the 70s, 80s, and 90s very systematically. Now, from a direction of an economic policymaker, it is, I don't believe that subsidies are the way to go to these developing countries, except under very extreme set of circumstances that need to be very carefully justified. And the reason is, again, fairness and equity. Because once you create subsidies, politically it's extremely difficult to remove them. So we need to find now mechanisms to be able to take proper action. And that's where I'm advocating a range of public policy interventions, from provision of infrastructure to provision of right marketing incentives and others. But particularly the issue becomes fairness of marketing relationship. And that's where WTO comes. That there is no level playing field for the agriculture of developing countries. Because with the current structure of subsidies, both in the United States and European Union and Japan, there's no possibility for an Afghan farmer, an African farmer, or Central American farmer to compete. And that, unfortunately, is the sad fact. There is beginning of traction on this in the WTO, but it's been extremely slow because the Doha round has not succeeded. Yes, please. Thank you again for a very, very profound question. The first part is that the silos have to be overcome. We have been trained in functional specialization, and the whole gets to be less than the sum of the parts. So the first part is a change in our own mental training capabilities to see the larger whole. Today, the nature of challenges is that post 9/11, we don't have two worlds. If we had the illusion that we had two worlds, one, a world of prosperity, functioning markets, democratic processes, and another world that was the debris of the Cold War, 9/11 put a very tragic end to that. We live in one world. We have to be able to focus on this one world with all its problems and all its opportunities, because there are no two worlds. And certainly there are no three worlds of development, unlike the 60s, when you had the option of the third world, etc. First point. Second, security, development, trade need to come together in reinforcing ways to focus on the fundamental question of the poor. If you have 2 billion you have 1 billion people living under $1 a day. You have another 2 billion working with margins of 2. This is not sustainable. So the question becomes, how do we look at the poor vis-a-vis mechanisms of their empowerment? Empowerment has become very powerful as a notion, because we talk about it in rich classes, in rich countries. What does it mean to be able to find mechanism for that? And the goal here is, unless you produce a global middle class and strive towards producing global middle classes, you're not going to get stability. That is the lesson of the history of Europe and the United States. Political stability in both Europe and the United States came when very large middle classes were produced. And these middle classes were produced through public policy. as I said earlier, without the GI Bill of Rights, you know, I had the privilege of writing a lot on GI Bill of Rights because most of my professors were product of that. And Professor Maslisch will be able to tell us a lot more about that, who is sitting in front here. So, because if security, development, etc., need to be brought from an integrated way, then we have to look at economic design from very different perspectives. Today, a whole set of policies are being prescribed to developing countries that have never worked in the developed world itself. We cannot operate in such doctrine manners. One last observation. Every country in the developed world that is developed defied the wisdom of the period. Gunnar Myrdal was predicting that Singapore was going to explode from its social tensions. It exploded into growth. The World Bank was arguing in 1950s that the two stars of Asia were going to be Burma and Philippines, and that Korea didn't have a prayer, or Taiwan. So agency really matters, imagination matters, ways of specifically putting different arrangements. And here, I think it is my generation was caught in the middle of one of the world's ideological conflicts. The market did not have legitimacy for us because we had a very, very strong romance with socialism. We really thought it was functioning, at least when we were in our teens. This now, a consensus has developed that markets have a distinctive space, that certain functions are best delivered to market. But markets cannot function without regulation because market failure is equally with us. So how do we find this balance becomes the critical challenge. And as part of this, our global institutions really need to be reorganized. We have to acquire the capabilities within the UN. There is no replacement to the UN in the political arena. You will not get an agreement on the Charter today or on the doctrine of Universal Declaration of Human Rights. These are global assets that really need to be credibly put. The World Bank has got a lot of problems and so have others. But what's the replacement? We need to be able to come with an agenda of fundamental reform of these, and these begin, again, from public discussion. Because what remains of John Dewey as an enduring legacy is his book on the public and its problems. Read it, you'll find it as refreshing as in 1929. Because the challenge was then again a globalized world. And in this context, the major thing that he argued was that you cannot constitute a public without discussion and debate. Because pragmatically, a goal has to be set in ways of achieving it. And this is why I'm arguing we need to join the discussion at the global level through creation of such fora and change the nature of engagement. Because human beings have always thought in two dimensions. Logically, you cannot derive ought from is. But for millennia, we've done it. And if we lose our capacity to think in two dimensions, we will lose our fundamental human capability for imagination. That most unidealist of philosophers, Karl Marx, said what distinguishes the worst of architects from the best of bees is imagination. Because the architect imagines what he needs to construct before he constructs it. So partly we need to rethink the future in ways that really require. And the environment is really the critical mark here. The environmental challenge profoundly affects our lives, and we need to reorganize public policy and public discourse in ways that we have hitherto had the luxury of not doing. Yes, please.
Related to that, my name is Hannah Plant. My question is, do you think the acceleration of global warming in the next 20 to 50 years and the crises that go with it could engender structural change in the aid system?
Could, yes, but it should. Because if, you know, I mean, one of the best expositions I've read is this book called Six Degrees. Because normally we take environment in global warming in very macro terms. Work it out as to what the consequences of 1 degree of warming at a time are and where the impact of this is going to be. First, it forces us to look back, because the guide to the future, unfortunately, lies in geology. It's geology that is giving us the longer perspective time. But the other is, we don't have 50 years to experiment. Because if any of this 1 degree at a time is correct, then the challenge that it poses to us is significant. As a consequence of this, if we take environment seriously, then we can take an entire range of public policy seriously. So what I'm saying is, let's use this area that is becoming an area of consensus and quite concern. If that is taken seriously, then the nature of public power changes. How does it change? The best of exercise of public power has been in functional terms. That specific ministries, specific organs, agencies have delivered specific functions. Today, with a whole series of cross-cutting issues, you can no longer do this in functional terms. And again, Singapore probably offers the best illustration, because one of the most imaginative acts of reimagining of state power that I've seen is taking place in Singapore. Because they're literally thinking through their future in different ways. They've exhausted all of scenario thinking and other modalities. Their budgeting has no parallel that I've seen. Why? Because they've come to terms with issues like aging. You cannot handle the aging issue, as the Singaporeans would argue, and Rahul is here to illustrate for you probably further, with functional divisions. You cannot create a ministry of aging. You know, in the past, if you had a problem, you create a ministry or agency, because lines were functional. But aging, environment, if you take the larger argument that now poverty is a global issue, poverty cannot be handled through functional things. We need to have an integrated, coherent set of perspectives. And if we manage to do this, then Singapore is an island nation, so its capability for thinking and reorganizing is radically different. Ireland, in other ways, is again, equally, in terms of spatial planning, one of the most creative things that I've seen in social policy in recent years has been the experience of Ireland. You know, Ireland, in the 90s, received 10 billion euros in assistance from the European Union. Ireland is going to be spending, in the next 5 years, 40 billion euros on social protection, on children, on disabled, on the elderly, because it is generating the wealth. So the point becomes, again, you know, if you want internal change, there are lots of examples where our stereotypes have proven wrong. When I was studying political science, it was common wisdom that Southern Europe could not be democratic. They were Catholics, after all. I mean, how could Catholics have practiced democracy? And dictatorship was inherent. Spain, Ireland, you know, Who raises that issue all of a sudden? In Chinese, didn't Max Weber say that Confucianism was inimical to capitalism? Now everybody's finding the Confucius spirit for the Chinese explanation. We need to be careful about linking culture at large to these sets of practices, because there's a lot more flexibility in that regard than we want to accord. Anna, did I see you raise your hand?
Yes.
I was going to ask what you thought it was going to take to change these organizations in the manner that you're talking about.
Well, I mean, first of all, in terms of the UN, reform of the UN will take 10 years. It is really broken. Minimally. So one should not, in the Secretary General of the UN is far more secretary than general. And that's the way it's designed. Building consensus, but the beginning of the reform of the UN is going to begin from money. One thing I learned from Max Weber that's been profoundly effective in my life, he said, those who don't work need to be supported by others. It was in the sociology of religion. He said, follow the money. And it has been a remarkable guide. The core of it, $10 billion a year now is spent on peacekeeping operations, and another $10 billion on the rest of things. Gaining control and establishing the right mechanisms of accountability is critical to this. Second is a people's issue. The UN should be a global body that really recruits globally. Instead, recruitment in the UN is one of the most patronage-ridden set of operations that the world has seen. In that regard, the opportunity here is that close to 30% of the UN staff is going to retire in the next 4 years. And it really offers. I would spend easily, if I were in charge of global policy, $100 million to buy the current staff of the UN out and begin fresh. Because it's then reach out to your generation, this generation, and make it one of the most significant alliances of development where the brightest mind from the world, based on competitive recruitment, are made both to understand theoretically, but also live conflict, poverty, directly. Everybody who's going to be a candidate for UN recruitment, it should be a badge of honor, and should live at the front line at least for 6 months to a year, so that theory and practice are really combined in ways, and a community develops, where the major preparation for this takes place. And then it's selectivity. I would abolish most of the UN agencies overnight and focus on three to four key issues. The model of technical assistance was a 1945 conception. Every single thing that can be done through technical assistance, $5 billion a year in Africa goes to technical assistance to employ 60,000 people from developing countries to write the reports for the developed countries that nobody reads. Accountability does not come through reporting in that manner. One index of functionality where citizens' views are reflected will far more powerfully. In terms of the World Bank, the core issue is that there are about 100 countries that require assistance during the next 20, 30 years. And one needs to be able to think economic system as a design issue, not as an issue of doctrine, and really connect and acquire the set of capabilities for these countries, and that requires a comprehensive set of capabilities that one can work across development, security, environment, set of issues to be able to bring holistic perspective. The problem of middle-income countries is not really the World Bank's problem. It could be if it's reorganized, but the core of the World Bank is that it's not a knowledge bank. It's one of those oversold McKinsey phrases that they convinced Jim Wolfensohn, who's an amazing man, that the bank actually was a knowledge bank. The debt is just not there. I give you one illustration to make my point. When I became finance minister, as you saw, I had a lot of other things on security and others, personal. I wanted to make sure that the Ministry of Finance did not bear my image, that it became a ministry, a functioning ministry that did things. So I asked the World Bank and the IMF two questions. What should the Ministry of Finance do? What should it not do? Because that's the core organizational question. You have to draw boundaries, because that means a five-year program of reform, etc., to be able to change it. They took 6 months, they failed to answer me. All they did was a number of dysfunctional cases. I wanted to know how Singapore had done it, how Chile had done it, how South Korea had done it. They knew nothing. I've documented all these places myself. That's why I was in Singapore and looking at it. Had that kind of information been available to me, I would have been able to do very different set of things. But the knowledge was not there. Still, the World Bank does not have a manual on how to run ministries of finance. I'm helping them now put together one. So the point is, again, that this model of contracting we assume is functional. We have assumed that there is a market where these services exist, that they can be purchased. The market is actually not there, because a number of firms who are superb at writing contracts cornered the market. One thing in terms of misjudging capability. You know, Afghans have been deprived for two generations of education. If you want accountability, there's a technical device that is key to accountability. It's called a single treasury account. What it simply means is that the government has one account. And you should know the income and expenditure of the country in the same day. It works in a week. Indonesia has 60,000 separate accounts. Still, an Afghan woman under 30, whom I appointed as the Director General of Treasury, within 1 year created a single treasury account in Afghanistan. And brought and trained Afghan women who had not seen a computer, they had not even seen a typewriter, to manage it within 2 years completely without foreign advice. What are we talking about? You know, the capability investing can be created, but we need, this is not rocket science. It literally is not. You know, I mean, the capabilities are very straightforward. How many auditors does it take? Sometimes 2,000, sometimes 200, sometimes 5,000. But training 5,000, you know, I was able to train auditors within 6 months at Kabul University. Four auditing firms have acquired the monopoly of auditing around the world. Why should auditing be a monopoly? This should be a common public skill that we should have. So I would reorient those set of capabilities, and most significantly, I'll make these institutions the catalyst for development of human capabilities in developing countries. You know what's the most neglected part of the of development in developing countries? What you are benefiting so readily from, higher education. The World Bank, again, through its misplaced concreteness, found out that in Latin America, the universities were preserves of the elite. So what does it do? Then it starts preaching to Africa and to Afghanistan and everybody else going to invest in higher education. For God's sake, you know, and after two generations of not having any capability, they literally did not want to put a cent in higher education in Afghanistan. I had to fight my way. So we need, I think, to change again, as Mayor so well said, our priorities, and to be able to reach and understand it. In almost every place that I've had the privilege of working, I've come upon a common neglect. No medium-term to long-term human development strategy. The poor would change if you provide the opportunity for upward social mobility. And we need to really focus together on making these global institutions the catalyst for upward social mobility that is sustained. And that takes an integrated set of approaches. And I think you are the key to this, because you will be able to change the mind of the people around the world by engaging in this discussion. One reason I've been so critical of the United States is because this is a free country and you can engage in discussion. And the other is, unless you engage in it, my saying it is not enough. Because as an Afghan, I'm rare, and I say it. And you know why most ministers of finance in the world will not talk to you like this? Because they're part of the same dependency. Their wages, the benefits of their children, the education of their children and scholarships here, depend on maintaining these networks. So we need to really put scrutiny on issues where we believe with our hearts, but if we don't bring our minds to it to change the mechanism, heart is not enough.
One last question. Ashok, can you be? Is that okay?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
David,
yes.
I'm David Davis, I'm economics here. I agree with most of what you said, but I don't think that your point about agricultural prices is sufficiently filled out. What's happened with biofuels now is running a natural experiment with very, very high food prices, A lot of the poor are now living in cities in many countries, maybe not Afghanistan. Cities are more politically unstable than rural areas. And when food prices go up very, very high, you often get a lot of political instability. And if you, on top of this now, removed all agricultural subsidies, even over a three-year period, given the environmental problems you referred to, I think we would have chaos. So I think that I'm all in favor of high food prices for third world farmers. That's not a point of disagreement. But I think given the world as it is, we need to think more carefully about that.
Well, thank you. I mean, I've given a lot of thought and attention to this. I really appreciate this. Just a couple of points. It is a question of social conflict as the wider problem within which I think we have to locate the urban and rural poor together. I'm not advocating a sudden sort of shift of shock therapy, but we need to begin the discussion in earnest. In closing any set of possibility at the very beginning is not helpful. Because the pendulum has been at that side. We need to open the discussion to a wide range of set of possibilities and adapt to context. There are different set of problems, and I'm not generalizing from Afghanistan. As I said, I have the privilege of working in China and India and the rest. But if you take India, agricultural subsidies in India have been among the most ineffective and have been captured by the elite. They have not been the mechanism of really bringing the poor in. Again, there's a wonderful book by...
I agree.
Yeah, so it's that. I think we can open and take very much into cognizance your very important insight that this should not be approached in a doctrinaire way. But the other point is to engage in a really meaningful debate as to what kind of public intervention is really required, so that we don't repeat the story of Brazil, where enormous amount of money goes from federal government, bypass the constitution, to the state and local governments, that is not spent on the purpose. So the result becomes, it is European type expenditure, but African result.
What was the book you were going to reference?
This is called Against the Gods. It's by Luce, the former Financial Times chief correspondent on India. It's a wonderful taking account, in particular, this chapter that deals with subsidies. And I mean, I work in India, two states as examples.
Don't worry, guys, I'm not assigning it.
it's an 80 week. I read it in a day, so I'm sure
I
read it in 6 hours. In Orissa, there were 60 dams that were 30%, 40%, 60%, 80% completed. But the trend was a politician would begin the dam so that the contracts could be awarded. But nobody was interested in finishing. And in Vietnam, again, which you said you've been working on, when I first arrived in 1994, one discovered this division of labor. The central government was supposed to build the main canal, the county, the provincial government secondary, and then the county, which had the least money, the tertiary, to get the farms. And as you could have seen, there were lots of canals where the first and the second were not aligned, and then the third one would not get built. So public policy needs to become effective in terms of the outcomes that we are seeking, and not just formalization of